For thousands of years, civilization has been a destructive force, both ecologically and culturally. Deep in the abyss of the sixth extinction, the future of humanity and our other-than-human kin hangs by a thread. At this pivotal moment in time, we must reach back into the depths of the human story and uncover our mistakes. I invite you to go with me down the rabbit hole as I seek out the silenced, forgotten, buried, abandoned, and demonized stories and practices of regenerative, egalitarian, place-based cultures. There is still time to reconnect with what we have lost, to restore our broken relationships to the land where we dwell, and to remember the human place in the wild. Hello, and welcome to the Rewilding Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Michael Bauer. I'm coming to you from Portland, Oregon, the traditional territory of the Multnomah and Clackamas Chinookan people, as well as the Kalapuya, Malala, Cowlitz, and many other tribal groups who have lived here, subsisted here, and traveled here to trade and make their living since time immemorial. This podcast is produced in partnership with Rewild Portland, a nonprofit organization, and is made possible through financial support from our listeners. The best way to keep the podcast going is to become a recurring monthly supporter. If you feel inspired to contribute, you can make a donation by following the link in the podcast notes. You can also help by sharing our podcast on social media and writing us a review on iTunes. Today, my guest is Lucy O'Hagan, the founder and head of Wild Awake Ireland. I've followed Lucy's work for several years and continue to feel deeply inspired and in awe of the programs that she creates. I've been wanting to interview Lucy for some time now, firstly to elevate her school, but also while our organizations are similar in style and content, the cultural and historical context in which they sit is very different. This is something I find interesting and wanted to know more about. If rewilding is to be widely appealing, we need to understand the multiple contexts that make it look and feel different so that we can understand how to appropriately rewild in those contexts. So before I jump into the interview, I want to talk briefly about some of the context we'll be discussing today. Rewilding involves going on a journey to understand where we came from, to learn the story of how each of us got to where we are now, and what was lost, forgotten, or silenced along the way. Not necessarily so we can go back to those specific culture or cultural practices, but to know the importance and function of ancient place-based lifeways. Even if they are not the most ideal, they were probably better than global capitalism. I'm interested in my familial lineages, not so much to appropriate from the past, but to understand how and why I landed where I live today. Everywhere in the world, civilization, through colonialism, attempts to tame the wild. And when it can't, it will exterminate whatever won't be tamed. For this reason, rewilding requires collective dismantling of colonization, or decolonization. As a white American reaping the benefits of a racist form of settler colonialism, I am very curious about what contemporary colonialism looks like in other countries, and in particular, of my own ancestral lineage. Culture is in constant flux, but colonization is a non-consensual forced change. Those who are colonized often go on to colonize others. As someone who landed where I am due to the diaspora inflicted by state violence, coercion, and colonization, and as someone who benefits in certain ways from the continued occupation of the land where I live, if I want to dismantle colonial structures, I need to understand them. If you're unfamiliar with the term colonialism and or settler colonialism, or if you want a refresher on what those concepts are, I've included links in the podcast notes for listeners to further explore. While Europe is known for its colonization during the rise of capitalism over the last 500 years, the continent itself has experienced three major waves of colonization prior. The first were agriculturalists from the Middle East who migrated into the region 7,000 years ago, replacing the hunter-gatherer populations who had been there since sharing the region with Neanderthals some 40 to 60,000 years ago. The second wave was the cultural group known as the Proto-Indo-Europeans, who came out of the Caucasus Mountains 4,500 years ago and linguistically homogenized the region, extinguishing most of the original indigenous languages there, with Basque, Finnish, and Hungarian being the three well-known languages that survived today. The third wave of colonization was the Roman Empire, While some say the Roman Empire collapsed, I believe that more accurately, it merely decentralized into micro-Romes that would later give rise to the nation-states that exist today. Ireland is an island country that was most recently colonized by England during its capitalist expansion starting 500 years ago. Wild Awake Ireland is a school nestled in this colonial history. This context is similar in some ways and very different in others from Rewild Portland. A huge difference is that I am not native or indigenous to this place, nor have I any claims over my ancestral lineage to the Portland area and beyond. While we all migrated from various places on the planet to where we live today, there is something special about generations of people dwelling within the same region or within the same bioregion. People with a cultural memory of what was there and how they lived prior to colonization. This is part of the context for the dialogue that we'll have today with Lucy. So let's jump in. Thank you for coming on the show. I don't know when I first started interacting with you, but I remember, my first interaction is that maybe you were considering calling your organization Rewild Ireland. Is that true?
Yeah. I think way back, I think I first came across Rewild Portland through a friend of mine who's from the States called Beth, and she had put me on to your work. And that was maybe like 6 years ago, I guess. Yeah.
Crazy.
So it's been a long time following your work and being really, really inspired by the work of Rewild Portland.
Awesome. Yeah, it's cool to see similar organizations popping up around the globe. And in particular, it's because we're both English-speaking countries, it's interesting to be able to like actually know what you're up to, whereas there's other countries, you know, where in Europe in particular, where people are doing stuff, but I don't really understand how to follow them because they're not English speaking countries.
Yeah.
But what inspired you to start your organization?
I suppose way back when I first contacted you, I had just done my forest school practitioner training. So part of what I do is I run a forest school in Dublin. Yeah, I was really inspired by that movement, which was particularly working with young people. And I had been working in kind of environmental education sphere for a long time. And yeah, I guess a lot of the language used around that work was, you know, this kind of classic conservationist approach of like, okay, nature is over there and we're not going to touch it. We're going to teach the kids about recycling and climate change and terrify them, essentially. Never go outside, or at least to just like they weren't feeling like they were a part of it. And I read Richard Louv's book Last Child in the Woods, and I heard about forest school, and I became involved in that movement. And I was really interested in a lot of anarchist pedagogy at that time, and still am. And it seemed to kind of fit in with my ethics and my values. And then sort of becoming more involved with that movement and being really inspired by like the HGLs movement. And then a lot of the stuff that I witnessed was people like, you know, trying to grasp for something culturally significant to them, but, you know, looking to frameworks in Native American cultures and just feeling really uncomfortable with a lot of the stuff that I was witnessing and, really wanting to acknowledge like cultural appropriation and like the seriousness of that and just find things that were culturally significant to Ireland, because it's such a rich country, such rich cultural practices, and we really need to be reweaving that into our daily lives and how we're presenting our interactions with nature. I don't know. What was the question again?
It was just what inspired you to start Wild Awake Ireland. That's awesome.
It was a huge part of it. And then because I was doing forest school, but then I was also teaching like ancestral skills and foraging and wildlife tracking, and everything that I was doing just kept growing and growing and growing. So I thought, right, I need to start like an organization, because I started the forest school first, right? So I needed something bigger that was sort of all encompassing of what I was doing. And that's just continually evolving and growing and changing. And yeah, it's exciting.
Cool. In terms of where you learned a lot of your skills and stuff like that? Are there any teachers or mentors that you like to shout out or say is like part of your inspiration?
Yeah. So the first person that I, well, the first people that I learned from were Circle of Life Rediscovery in Sussex. So they trained me in Forest School, and they're really influenced by the Eight Shields method. So they were amazing. I don't know what would have happened if I had been trained by any other organization, because they really brought in like this mentoring, like the values of that. And then after that, so the Forest School training is a 9 months long training where you, it's kind of 9 days contact time, but you spend a year making like your own booklet. And when I finished that, it was kind of like, okay, so now I have this piece of paper that tells me that I can go outdoors and teach kids like how to light fires and use knives, but actually I don't really know how to do that.
Totally. You know? Yeah.
And I was so inspired by it all. It was like really reawakened something in me that I'd loved as a child, but I'd lost for so much of my life. So I went to a school over in Sussex called the Woodcraft School, which is run by a guy called John Ryder. So he's amazing. He's really kind of, he's a big person in growing the tracking movement in the UK and in Europe, like an incredible naturalist. So I learned a lot about ethnobotany through him, and bushcraft, and now I like wildlife tracking and trailing. Awesome. So I do a lot of my cyber tracker work.
Yeah, I saw that you got your certification. That's rad.
Yeah. Still don't know how. I still feel really terrible. But the good thing about these practices is you just keep practicing.
Totally.
So yeah, I learned with John for about 2 years. I'm still always learning with John. And then Lynx Vilden came to Ireland 2 years ago, and that kind of blew my mind, really, because I was doing a bushcraft instructor's course at the time, which was like a 10-month program. Yeah, I loved it. And it was kind of like, I didn't know what else there was to do to satisfy my need for being with nature and for teaching these skills. I was the only woman on the course. There was no gratitude. There was no check-ins in the morning. There was none of the stuff that I love.
This is the bushcraft class.
Yeah. It's not Lynx's class. Right. Like, obviously. Yeah. she came to Ireland, and it was a really life-changing moment for me in what I do. And it was hugely emotional, you know, like so much grief for me. This one really life-changing moment was she brought us all into this tent, and there were between 12 and 15 people on the class, the youngest being about 2 and the eldest being in their 60s. And she asked us to each one by one to say, what is the most important thing to you in your life right now? And I just had never really been asked that question, it felt like, let alone to speak that loud in front of a group of people. That really shifted a lot in me. And I kind of haven't looked back since. Started following us around. And then we'll be coming to help her in Washington.
Yeah, awesome.
Next year. Yeah, I'm really excited. Yeah. But we're there.
That's so cool.
So yeah, it's been a long, still unfolding journey.
Cool.
And the exciting part now is just having learned from all these amazing teachers, just trying to figure out what is the cultural significance of this in Ireland, and what do we need here.
Yeah. So that kind of makes me think of another question, which is, here in the United States, colonization has more to do with like racial divides in terms of like, you know, settler white people and native people, you know, so there's a whole set of challenges that we face in terms of rewilding and collaborating and creating a future together here. I'm curious what it's like over there, because Ireland, you know, I mean, has been colonized multiple times. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about like how that relates to rewilding? And what is the situation like there?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few different things that I can think of. So one would be, I suppose, like addressing the colonization of Ireland and that we've lost so much of our own rituals and so many of our cultural practices and, like our relationship to the land. Like the famine is still, it wasn't that long ago, and people were really betrayed by the land. And I think that's really lived on, but especially when I'm teaching foraging, so many people don't engage with plants or animals and kind of seem to forget that we live on an island, like don't gather that much seaweed. There's not as much of a practice of going to gather seaweed for your garden. So like, yeah, a huge part of that is like being betrayed by, or like that feeling of being betrayed by the land. And then also like the loss of our language was enormous. Like it's just, it reflects so much of how we relate to the land and like our belonging here. It's different for me because I grew up in Belfast. So I grew up in the north of Ireland. So I don't know if you're like familiar a lot with the history there, but there was like, so the north of Ireland are the six counties which remained under English rule after partition. So there's the Republic of Ireland, which is where I and work now, and then the north of Ireland. And in the north of Ireland, there was like majority kind of Protestant unionist people who wanted to stay like and remain a part of the United Kingdom, and then people who were predominantly nationalist or Catholic who wanted to remain part of Ireland. So there's been huge violence there, which is still very much in my lifetime. So growing up as a Catholic in Belfast and then like moving to a very sectarian town growing up, it never felt safe to practice kind of Irish traditional cultural practices or speak Irish. Or yeah, like I remember going to the south of Ireland, so the Republic of Ireland, as a child, and I would see like an Irish flag if we went into a bar, because like we kind of grew up in bars if we went on holiday with family. Like the parents could just go to the bar and drink, and we would just be friends with all the other kids.
That's awesome.
But like, or even as an adult, going into these bars and seeing like the rebels of the Irish Revolution or an Irish flag, and feeling like really kind of like, oh, this is a really dodgy bar. This is not a safe place, but actually it's fine here. It's just in the north of Ireland, it's different. So that's been really interesting for me in this work to kind of try and figure out like what is my place in all of this, like what is my connection to Irish culture, and yeah, that sense of belonging is so prevalent for all of us. And then another thing which comes to mind is obviously like Irish travellers in Ireland. So they were finally recognized as the Indigenous ethnic minority of Ireland only 2 years ago. So it's kind of like there's still a huge divide between the Irish population and Irish travelers. People often describe it as kind of the last acceptable form of racism here. Still so much mistrust between the communities, lots of stereotypes and discrimination. And yeah, it's like they have such an incredible wealth of knowledge about this land and the plants, everything. And it's just trying to find the people to connect with that want to share that, so like yeah, sure, with your explorations of rewilding, that it needs to be a kind of everybody in, and being really aware of, yeah, our own privilege in moving this forward. Yeah, it's complicated for sure.
That's cool about Irish travelers. I didn't know that they were recognized in terms of their that recognition as them being an indigenous population. Is that like recognizing that they've been there forever? Or like what does that mean to
Yeah. As far like my understanding is like that recognizing that they are a distinct population, that
Okay.
they're yeah, that they're like genetically different to the rest of the Irish population,
Interesting.
and with their own distinct culture and
Yeah.
languages, yeah, and
That's
way of life.
amazing.
So,
Yeah.
yeah, like it's really, really amazing. And I think really the Irish state has still so much to answer to because so many of those children, in the same way as like colonization worked
Right.
across the world, you know, like yes, Ireland was colonized, but then Ireland in turn tried to colonize this ethnic minority by taking those children, like putting them in schools, in industrial schools, trying to
Yeah.
take their language away from them, trying to make them settle and assimilate into mainstream Irish culture. So yeah, there's a dark, dark, dark side to
Interesting.
every country, like, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just curious, it's just interesting to hear how colonization takes shapes in other places, and being a settler here in the United States, it's always a weird thing to try to like think about the idea of like my own indigenous ancestry, whatever that means. I have so many threads that go all over the world, and then even then they're only in those places for a certain amount of time, so it's hard for me to kind of like track where I would ever feel at home in that sense.
Yeah.
Other than where I live right now, where I grew up and feel this, Portland feels like my home. But in terms of like ancestral lineage, my family's only been here for 130 years. So it's just an interesting thing to think about, in terms of how it plays out here in the United States. The idea of being indigenous or being from a place, is a very like colonial time stamp, if that makes any sense. And so it's just like a, it's a weird thing to explore globally, like where. At the point of colonization is generally when people like take the snapshot of like where you're from, right? So like
Yeah.
for me, looking back in my own ancestry to find like the indigenous thing, I try to look for that point of like where was my ancestral line colonized, right? And that to me would be like where my family would be indigenous to.
Yeah.
And again, there's so many different family strains and lines and stuff for me. It's kind of all over the map, but there's also like the genetic testing or whatever, and I've done that, and that's like 99.99% broadly Northern European. So, I'm always like, wow, I need to go there and check that out and, feel what it feels
Yeah.
like to be there. So anyway, just interesting to hear like how colonization affects the populations of places in the, outside of the United States, because I'm super unfamiliar with it, and in particular Europe, because that's where my ancestry comes from. So anyway, thanks for sharing that.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned to me was, you're doing a Tending the Wild class. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And also, I'm curious if it's inspired by Kat Anderson's book Tending the Wild, that's for like the Northern California native people.
I only discovered her work after I called it Tending the Wild, and I got
Yeah,
the book and was like, oh,
nice.
not touching it. But yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, so Tending the Wild, I ran the first one in October of this year, and it takes place in County Donegal, which is the most northwesterly county of Ireland, in a tiny little Gaeltacht area, called Fallcarragh is the closest town. And yeah, it's a week long, and we stay in a place called the Songhouse, which was originally the poet's house. So poets such as Seamus Heaney, like some of our great Irish poets, would have gone there to learn and to teach. And yeah, it's a place that I have strong connections with. We would have gone there a lot as children, and my sister lives there now. So it's a really, really beautiful place. And I started to plan this. Yeah, that's, I suppose, like people were calling it a retreat, but I heard this really nice thing recently of like, yeah, not calling it a retreat, but more of like stepping in. Like, I don't want to be saying to people, we need to retreat from this like civilization which is harming us. It's more like, no, let's like step into a new way of being, you know?
I like that.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense to me. So yeah, anyway, it's 5 days, and We go to different environments each day. So we're foraging from rivers, and there's a beautiful coastline there, and doing a lot of seaweed foraging, and from the bogs and yeah, the meadows and hedgerows and the forests. And then I've been linking in with local poets, and so a very famous Irish poet called Cathal O'Sharkey, who lives there and is a great family friend of ours. He married my sister and her partner, or like some mad pagan ceremony, I'm not sure it was. So he lives there at the foot of Errigal Mountain, and he's a native Irish speaker. So he started speaking English when he, well, he first heard English when he was maybe 13.
Wow.
Yeah, so he's beautiful wordsmith, incredible person, and great crack. And then there's a native herbalist from that area called Margaret Kitty. Again, didn't start speaking English until she was 13, 14. Learned all of her herbal knowledge from her mother, who learned it from her grandmother, and so on, and really doesn't know the names, like the English names of the plants.
That's awesome.
She came to do a class, and bless her, she was so nervous because she had to speak for 2 hours, you know, and like know the plant names. So just so amazing to be there with these people. And we think about like those kind of indigenous voices of that land, you know, they're so connected with that landscape, like they're just have grown from it. So yeah, it feels really, really important, especially like kind of doing this form of, I suppose it's like a kind of ecotourism. I really don't like the word, but it is a little bit. But you know, there's so many people who will come and do this in Ireland, but not actually link in with the local people or the local communities. So that was really important to me. And then, yeah, my friend Sean Fitzgerald, he does the folklore. So really, like, it's a place that's really, really rich in very ancient Irish folklore. So he comes and kind of places us in the landscape according to our mythology. And yeah, his artwork is amazing, if you ever can check it out.
Yeah, I have like so many questions going in so many different directions now. So you're curating this, right? Like you're essentially the facilitator. So you've found these people that have these skills, and you're like bringing them together to create the opportunity for people to learn from them. Is that right?
Yeah. So the mornings are spent with me. So going out and identifying plants and learning how to forage them sustainably. And then the afternoons bring in like these other voices. And then we finish it with the wild feast at the end, where these people come back and share in the feast as well, which they love because they are, you know, even Margaret Kitty, she knows all these uses of plants, but you know, we were making like mussels from the coast with like rosehip and tomato sauce and like loads of ferments and like wild mushroom and acorn duck cell.
Oh,
and
my they God. Were
like, you know, like, we've never eaten these, like, just had nettles in porridge, you know? Like,
yeah.
This kind of new creativity coming in. So, yeah, and then it's all like really interwoven with ceremony. Yeah, I love that. And it's always just, I just like responding to whoever turns up in any of my classes. Like, it's really important that ceremony is really important to me, but it's really important to me that people feel like safe and a part of creating that, because it's just really meaningless otherwise.
Totally.
So the first one was beautiful, and the next one is in April, so 9th to the 14th of April, and it's planned around the sort of super low tides of the spring full moon, just to do a lot of coastal foraging.
Awesome. That's so cool. Do you speak Irish, or are you learning Irish? Is that anything you're interested in doing?
It's something I'm definitely interested in doing, along with everything else. Not yet. I did learn Irish for a few years in school, and like there's a thing in Ireland where you go to a Gaeltacht, so school children, if they're in like a Catholic school, especially in the north of Ireland, they'll go to the Gaeltacht and stay there for a whole summer to learn Irish, but it's just an excuse to go drinking and I didn't last very long. Yeah. She kicked out for 2 weeks.
Oh, no.
Kind of put an end to my Irish learning. But I'd love to do it again, especially up in Donegal, because there's different dialects of Irish around Ireland. So, yeah, I'm an Ulster woman, so I would learn Ulster dialect.
It's funny. There's actually the language program that I used to learn Chinook Wawa, which is like the native trade language here in the Northwest. They also have used that, like the only other really prolific organization that has used that framework is like an Irish group in Portland. And so like, it's one of those things where I'm like, you know, Irish isn't really I'm more interested in learning Germanic stuff, but there's a huge like contingency of Irish language learning folks in Portland. It's such a weird.
I know. I'm like on Instagram, I see this all the time, and I'm always so inspired. I think it's like their name is Joan, like Forest Farrell Lyon, and they've learned Irish flat out. And I'm like, oh my God, they're going to come over here in January. So hopefully they can teach them.
That's super cool.
But it is really interesting, like, being on Instagram now and seeing all of these. I mean, obviously, so many of the people there have Irish ancestry, but it's like so much more Irish than Irish people themselves, you know, like this full-on Irishophile. But yeah, I'm super inspired to learn it at the point when I have more time.
Cool. You also said, you mentioned to me that you're weaving Irish myth and folklore into your work. And I'm really curious about that. And is that, you said you were raised Catholic. Do you still, is there any kind of like mixture of that, or did you reject that? Or like, what's your connection for, you know, what's your story in regards to like folklore and religion? And, you know, you mentioned that you do ceremony with attending the wild class. Like, you know, is that like a ceremony that anybody could partake in? Is it something that's like denominational specific, or what's your framework for essentially spirituality, religion, and that sort of connection?
So I was raised Catholic. I rejected that. I guess it really, when I was a teenager, I was really into like Wiccan and like nature-based spirituality. Before I was a teenager, we moved out to the countryside, and it was really rural. My brother and sister had left. My house was not like a very safe place to stay in. So I was so often like in the fields and in the forests. And that was like really important for me growing up. And I had a really strong connection with the land then. And then I remember in school, I brought all these spell books in, you know, and I went to like an Irish all girls Catholic convent, and they were terrified. Yeah. You know, they thought I was worshiping the devil. Mm-hmm. They called all my friends out one by one. They came in, made us say decades of the rosary.
Wow.
There's such a fear, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I came home and told my mom, she freaked out because she'd been raised in like this really strict Catholic upbringing, and she threw out all my spell books, destroyed my altar, and it was kind of like persecution.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you're a teenager and you're trying to find your identity, and mine was so much based in this nature-based spirituality, so I really lost it after that, you know. And I didn't come back to it until really like doing Lynx's classes is where I started to feel a lot more comfortable with it, because I'd witnessed ceremony being done badly and with a lot of cultural appropriation and a lot of just not really understanding what it was about. So I'd felt really alienated from it for a long time and felt like it was really unsafe to explore. And then doing Lynx's classes kind of realized. And actually, at the time, it was when we were in the caves in France for a month. I did a month-long class in France. And I was reading Braiding Sweetgrass at the time. And Robin Wall Kimmerer had this quote around, like, she was talking about cultural appropriation, and around, I wish I could remember it, but something about community creating ceremony and ceremony creating community. And that really stuck with me. And I noticed a lot in our community for that month when we were doing something. There was, yeah, we were creating it together, whether that was just, you know, spending a little bit of time before before doing something, talking about it, like the Thanksgiving circles, the, yeah, just figuring out like what makes sense to us without just stealing something from totally. Another culture, putting our stamp on it, you know. So like that really started to get me more comfortable with it, more creative with it. And then coming back to Ireland, then after being in Sweden for 3 months last year, I was like, okay, right, I'm going to try and figure this out. And that's still ongoing. Like, I have, by no means do I have the answer now, but reading a lot more of our mythology, and learning a lot more about it, you know, starting to understand that there are possible like creation stories in our folklore. There's so many, yeah, like these amazing gods, the Tuatha Dé Danann, like this race of gods which roamed the land of Ireland, and how they were gods and goddesses, but also like regular humans, in that they were subject to the laws of nature, just like everybody. And that was like, that's so beautiful. I love that. Yeah, like these goddesses associated with herbalism and healing, like Eärmid, and then like all these other characters that come up who are like Leolucra, who's an amazing tracker and trained. Like there were so many women warriors who trained, like these really famous male like characters like Cuchulainn and Setanta, which we like, I would have grown up with those stories, but now like kind of digging further into them, it's like, oh, they were all trained by women. That's interesting. So I'm bringing that a lot into the rite of passage program at the moment. And yeah, so like, yeah, and answering your question, it's still not totally clear in my mind, and I'm still learning as much as I can, but just really knowing that it needs to be culturally significant for it to have any kind of meaning for people. And it's so, like, it's so present in Ireland at the moment. Like, there is this real reclaiming of our ancient festivals, like Samhain. But it's really odd. I went to a Samhain festival there. So Samhain's like the ancient festival that marks the end of the harvest. It's now known as Halloween, the time where the veil between this world and the other are so thin. The mark of the Celtic New Year. So there's so much funding for councils in Ireland to have like these huge festivals for Samhain now. And I went to a really amazing one in County Meath, where I live. I am on the hill of Chocta, so really ancient site, like a lot of the places in this county. And there was a huge like ceremony there, but it was also a performance. And it was like there were people who were there like me for it as a ceremony, but then loads of people on their smartphones like pushing to, and like this really weird kind of thing going on at the moment, where it's like people feel like it's really intensely spiritual for them, and there's something very familiar about it, but at the same time it's like this performance essentially, and we're still very detached from it. But it's great to see like, and to hear so many more people talking about these festivals and talking about like embodying, you know, what these mythological figures represent in our current age. So interesting times.
Yeah, it's so awesome. there's like this sort of deep-seated jealousy, I think, in me, like when I was, you know, hearing about the stuff that you're doing, just because you know, there's all, it's like the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Like just the stuff that the challenges that we face here, when I say we, and like non-native settler rewilders in someone else's land and not really having that history or that mythology that's here with us, you know what I mean? There's definitely like a deep sadness in that regard, but also because I think, you know, people tend to think, well, you should just like research your own ancestry and stuff. But if you understand paganism or, you know, pagan animism, what you do is you worship or give offerings to the gods of the specific places. So like if I were to research my Germanic ancestry, that would be interesting, but mm-hmm. I wouldn't be like giving offerings to them here. I'm on the other side of the world. Like if you travel, when you were in pagan societies and you would travel to other places, you were literally giving offerings to the gods of those places, and the gods changed depending on the place you were at. So like mm-hmm. here, if I were to follow that tradition, then I would be leaving offerings to Chinookan and Malalan and Kalapuya people's gods or spirits or whatever. But then that's cultural appropriation too. So there's just like, you know, and there's so much complexity to it that it's just it's one of those things that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And I just wish there was, on some level, I feel like it would be so simple if I was just in another place. But then I also think that there's other things going on there. That's why I was asking you about like colonization in Ireland, because I know it's never as simple as like, if I just go there, then it would be all easy, right?
Yeah, but there's yeah, and that's like so much like how, well, not exactly the same, but you know, I do feel that sometimes coming from the north of Ireland, and it's like, well, who am I? Like, where do I belong? You know, and like trying to dig deeper into our culture. But that's why I love practicing ancestral skills so much, you know, because it's like there's a universality, like
totally,
yeah, to it. And tracking, you know, like, and really going directly to the source to receive those teachings. Like, yeah, I just think it's so important in that conversation of what is it to be Indigenous to a place. It's like those teachings, like, and what we're learning from, like, those people learn from nature as well, like, and from observing, like, what are the seasons doing now, you know, like, what are the lessons from the yew tree that stands outside my door, like what are the lessons from the birds that are coming and going, or like who lives in my area, like what plants, and yeah, just like I think it's so important. Like that's what I'm really excited about, reweaving that with all of these ancestral practices that are happening in Ireland at the moment, because there is such like a huge push to revive our mythology and what it means to be rooted to this land. But yeah, for me personally that feels kind of meaningless if you go outside your door and you don't know like the names of the plants. I mean, absolutely. Maybe you don't even need to know the names, but just to like have an understanding of how they grow and what they need and where they grow, or who are the animals that are local to your place. It's just like, it's such a wider picture than, mm-hmm. it's just another human-centric kind of mm-hmm. practice, then, isn't it? Like, yeah. So.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you said in terms of going to the source. Like that's, that to me just sums it all up. Like, yeah, you have to actually be interacting with the place that you're in, and that's where all of that stuff came from, so.
Yeah, someone described it to me as original instructions. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that comes from, but that made a lot of sense to me.
That's a Haudenosaunee Iroquois saying. It's from the Thanksgiving address. Cool. So you started Rewild in the City, which is your monthly donation-based skill series. And that was partly, you said, inspired by Rewild Portland. Can you talk to me about that? And why did you choose to do it? And how are you seeing that affect the people in your area?
So I started that 3 years ago now. So it takes place one Sunday a month in the Phoenix Park in Dublin. So Dublin being the capital of Ireland, and Sorry, my phone was logged in. I'm just trying to... So it takes place in Dublin in the Phoenix Park. So the Phoenix Park is like the biggest park attached to any European city. So that's where I run the Forest School from, and then a lot of my other work. This has been going really well. And I sort of take a different theme each month. So we had wildlife tracking this month. Next month will be prehistoric lighting techniques, and then weaving together all of these, the mythology and what the season is teaching us as well. It seems to be like, for the people that do come, like, very beneficial to them, especially to have access to these skills that are affordable to them, and also accessible from the city as well. You know, it's like, this park is pretty much the same size as Dublin city centre. It's enormous.
Wow.
And we're able to use this really, like, this pocket of it that's managed very lightly. So it's pretty cool. Like, mm-hmm. I'm very, very lucky to have access to that part of Dublin.
Do you end up teaching most of those, or is it kind of a similar thing to your Tending the Wild where you're bringing in other folks?
Yeah, currently I'm teaching it because it's donation-based. So, I just applied for funding for it. So hopefully it can become a free skills series. That would ultimately be the dream for it, you know. It's just like I'm so much in awe of Rewild Portland because of how you're organized, you know, and really recognizing the limitations of what I'm doing, because it's not a not-for-profit. And it's predominantly me at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I have of people who are working now at the Forest School, and there's more people coming in volunteering for that. There's definitely a lot of work to be done with it and making it like much more accessible to the people that really need it, and really diversifying like the people who come and learn and the people who are teaching as well. Like, I saw you did this seed saving one recently. And like, that's just it's so brilliant, you know, doing things like that as well. So there's work to be done on it, but I'm happy that it's still going. And it feels like the people who are turning up are turning up.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, this is our last month in October was our first, 10-year anniversary of doing the Free Skill Series. So the first one was in October of 2009. And you know, it's funny because I was just tracking through time, like all of the different themes that we've had and like trying to figure out how many people were coming to them and that kind of thing. But you know, at first we were just doing it like illegally in the park without a permit or anything. And then they were like, wait, you have insurance and you're offering free public programming. Like, we will sponsor you with a permit. And that was when we were able to actually then start like advertising it, and getting it to grow. But it's the same kind of thing of, you know, over here, where we're constantly struggling for funding for that program. I mean, it's the one program that we do that's like the most charitable. It's totally free. It's the longest program we've done. But it is basically subsidized by our paid programs, our tuition-based program. So I'm actually trying to figure out other ways to get funding, because I've never really been good at writing grants. But as a nonprofit, we're able to do that. But yeah. That makes me think of a couple of other questions for you. One is, there's this park, it's the largest park in Ireland. Yes. There's this thing, you know, like the word rewilding has a very different, connotation over there. Like, I have, you know, Google Alerts sends me weekly or daily announcements of like articles that are being written using the term rewilding. So I see like the spectrum of how people are using it. Everything from like a vegan beer hall in the United States to, you know, the Scottish sheep herders angry that their pastures are being taken away for rewilding efforts to turn it back to like an unmanaged, humanless environment, which, you know, harkens back to like the mythology of John Muir and these conservationists who believe that wild spaces meant there weren't any humans there, or that humans are inherently destructive, and so therefore, in order for nature to be pure, it needs to be untouched by humans. So did that influence your decision to not use the word rewild in your organization, or was that just something completely different? That's one question. but the other question is, like, how do you what are, like, the wild spaces like in Ireland if this is the largest park? There's no real, like, national parks, is that right? There's no, like, most of the land, there are national parks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, what do you answer first? No, it didn't influence my decision. I just wore a wild wig. I mean, it, like what you said, relating to kind of the public, I mean, rewilding has become so popular, like, in the public discourse over here as well, like, not just in how that would work ecologically, but also, like, on a social level. There's definitely still this fear around it being that, like, there's just going to be loads of land set aside and loads of farmers will lose their land, and it will be essentially a humanless space. Yeah, so that's definitely still something that people are thinking of here. But there are national parks in Ireland, and really, like, there really needs to be, because it's, you know, you're saying the grass is greener on the other side. The grass is really green here because it's so intensively farmed. Right. You know, like, when people think of green Ireland, it is because there are fields upon fields, and so many of those fields are also empty as our kind of farming practices change as well. And so many of the animals are kept inside. So yes, there are national parks, and there are places of, like, you know, special conservation, which seem to magically not be those anymore whenever there's a potential for profit. Like, there's a lot of projects for shale gas exploration, gold mining, like Oyster Bays, Ballyness Bay. So it's definitely one of those terms that people haven't fully grasped yet, and that's still, like, it's the same reason, right, that people still don't recognize themselves as a part of nature, and inherently think that humans are evil. And it really worries me, because so many of the young people that I work with still hold that belief, you know, like, they still think that humans are the evil ones, right, and we're the ones destroying the planet. And I just can't imagine how hard it is for so many of the young people now who are seeing that happening and just feel like it's our fault. And so the park that I work in Dublin, it's more like, it's not like a mountainous, like, really forested, you know, it was planted, it was used before as a hunting park for an English lord. that's the places in Ireland that are still forested, like, that have it's by no means ancient woodland. There's, like, barely any ancient woodland left in Ireland at all. But the places that are forested were owned, and some of them still are owned by Anglo-Norman settlers. Interesting.
Yeah. It's funny, like, the word poaching, I didn't really understand that. Like, the whole concept of poaching came specifically from people killing lords' deer and are hunting in the lords' or king's forests, you know, because that was, like, one of the ways that they believed, like, that they would maintain their dominance or predatory whatever. It was like training their children, the elite training their children to be hunters or something, and like not allowing peasants and settler or whatever farmers to do that. That's really weird that that's the forests that are left, but I guess it makes sense if they were keeping those intentionally for that purpose. So weird.
It's where, like, I live in County Meath, so it's the least forested county in Ireland, which is weird that I live here. But it's where all of our ancient sites are, you know. So it was a province in and of itself in the past. It was a really important province. We live on like an old Anglo-Norman estate. You know, they rented out the kind of gate lodges and things. So I live in a really forested area with a river, but otherwise that would be nearly impossible really to do in an affordable way, unless you move to the other side of Ireland. You know, it's pretty extreme housing crisis happening here, and has been happening for the past, well, since the
There's a lot of parallels here. I mean, Portland has the largest city park, or one of the largest city parks in the United States. So when you were talking about that, I was like, oh, that's probably just like it's called Forest Park. And it's basically just a park that was on a hillside that is really difficult to build on. So it's essentially like a huge park, but it's on a very steep incline, which is why it still exists. But also in terms of like, housing crisis and all that stuff, it's interesting seeing how these things are happening all over the world right now. It'll be interesting. Yeah. Just on a personal level, you told me in our exchange that you're just enjoying like moving with the seasons yourself and doing some subsistence stuff and crafting and things like that. Do you want to talk about that at all?
That's what I'm doing right now. So work's quieting down. Irish winter, very dark, very cold. So mostly doing a lot of crafting by the fire. We're doing like a short Stone Age project up in Finland in February. So I'm preparing manically for that at the moment. That's kind of like a practice that I've been trying to do in the past few years of just not, just not going into this like relentless productivity and really just like observing the seasons and trying to move a lot more with them. And it's hard. It's really hard, like particularly when you run your own business. I mean, I sort of say that this is my downtime, but in all actuality, this is the time where all of the admin needs to be done and everything in your head. And it's like, oh, actually that list is way bigger than any of the other times, you know, the summer's all outside and running programs and it's the time to do taxes and all the fun stuff. I love this time of year here, and it's just, the fire's lit and picking up the last of the nettles and drying stuff and just enjoying all that I've harvested all over the year.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. I feel like I could just keep talking to you about all kinds of other things. But alas, it's already been almost an hour. Do you have any questions for me?
I remember a while ago you were talking about creating kind of like a rewild blueprint for organizations. Is that still something that you're planning to do?
Yeah, great segue into this thing I wanted to talk about, actually, that I always forgot about. So one of the things that we, in 2006, when I created the Rewild Forum, the International Rewild Forum, one of the things we wanted to do was inspire people to start doing essentially the free skill series in their towns. And the first one we ever did was in 2007. We were not officially Rewild Portland at that time. It was just anybody could do this thing. And we did like a week long open space technology gathering in the parks. Again, it was totally under the radar, but there were probably 100 people who came through and during the week learning and teaching different things. It was pretty awesome. But we were really trying to push people to start their own, like to leverage the online community at rewild.com to create pockets of rewilding in real life. Because one of the biggest things people complained about on the site was like, oh, this is great to like have people to talk to here, but I still don't have anybody where I live. I'm like an island or I'm isolated. And so we were like, you know, one of the things I did was I wrote a press release and instructions for how to run a Rewild Skillshare. At the time, we called it Rewild Camp, but people got confused and thought we were actually camping. I'm like, no, it's just like a day-long thing. So I wrote like an instructions for that, and then a couple people started actually doing them. But it kind of fizzled out. And at one point I was just like, this isn't going to work unless there's a model, like a working functional thing that is like successful and other people see. And that's when I kind of stopped being online as much and retired the Urban Scout project and started Rewild Portland to basically be that model. And over the years, there's been a lot of people who've been inspired by us and doing these free skill series and stuff. And now there's like a few actually established organizations that are very similar in capacity to us and in our values. And also there's organizations that are using the word rewilding that are not doing those things, that are not really sharing our values. And so we want to, in order to like protect the term and the idea and the value so that people don't get us confused, one of the ideas that we have that we're putting together is called the Rewilding Alliance. Mm-hmm. And it will basically be a set of cultural values, and it will have a council, and organizations can elect to be a member of the alliance, insofar as if I'm looking for a project and I want to make sure that it matches my values, if I see some organization that is using the word rewilding or something else and I want to make sure, I can like go to the Rewilding Alliance page and make sure that they're like listed there, or there's like some sort of seal or emblem or something that is like not really licensed, because, you know, I don't know if we'll ever end up actually doing the legality of that, but whatever the grassroots version of licensed is, you know, approved through a council of people who are basically maintaining a set of values. You know, things like land acknowledgements and cultural appropriation, and who, you know, access, making sure that there's a, you know, one of the main components is that you, as an organization, are offering monthly free classes to the public. To create access to that. So, you know, like you're doing that. Rewild Maine is doing that. There's a sort of off and on Rewild Nevada City. There's a Rewild Pittsburgh that's sort of always kind of simmering. And a bunch of other organizations that are like in chats with me to do similar stuff. I know that the Rewild Project, I think in Scotland, or yeah, I think it's in Scotland. I'm going to talk with them. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm interviewing Scott, one of the main people from that, in a couple of weeks. But, you know, just trying to figure out how to get everybody on the same page so that we're, as organizations in this movement, able to like make sure that our morals and ethics are being held to a higher standard than somebody who's just doing it to capitalize on the term. Which I've seen a lot of, you know, especially like in terms of the paleo diet community, which is rife with capitalist enterprise anyway. Turning rewilding into a capitalist enterprise is super disgusting to me. So trying to connect everybody who's doing similar types of things and unite under a kind of moral, ethical framework that just holds us accountable to one another, I think is super important. And then also other people from parts of the world who are constantly asking me or other people like, oh, well, you know, I live way over here. Is there anything like that in my area? That would be a resource for them to go and look and make sure that it was something that matched with our values.
Global rewilding with integrity. Sounds amazing. Yeah. Other question. Can we hang out in June when I come over?
I'd love to hang out. Yes. Great. Cool. That'll be awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, Gurmagat Slán.
And I look forward to chatting with you again as your organization continues to grow and do awesome things.
Thanks, Peter.
There are so many threads to follow from my conversation with Lucy. This has me deeply pondering the same questions that I've been sitting with for many years, and I feel rest at the heart of rewilding. Rather than speaking more about these things just yet, I will leave you with questions. If all humans have been migratory for millions of years, if our ancestral lineages are linked to multiple places all over the earth, how then does this change the perception of what we mean by ancestral homeland? At what point does our identity to a certain time and a certain place and a certain culture and history hinder or help our movement forward in rewilding? How can we authentically connect to the places where we live today so that we are not culturally appropriating from the cultures of the places where we live or from distant ancient cultures with no relevance to the place where we live today? What are the ways in which we can connect to the source of culture, the land itself, and create something new and beautiful together? What power structures has empire created that keep us from collaborating with the land and with indigenous people that we are blind to? I admire Lucy because she went for it. She's doing the work. It's inspiring to see people just go for it and become catalysts for the rewilding movement. I envy Lucy in that she still dwells in the place of her most recent ancestors, though I understand that it comes with a whole different set of challenges, and that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. I'm happy that I live where I do, and though there is a lot of culture repair to be done here, I wouldn't have it any other way. You can follow and connect with Lucy on Instagram at Wild Awake Ireland. I've included more links to connect with Lucy and many links to topics, people, and resources that we mentioned during our conversation in the podcast notes. If you like this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and if you'd like to see this podcast continue to grow and flourish, become a financial supporter by following the link in the podcast notes. Thanks so much. We'll catch you next time.